He had thought the Enabling Act a crazy idea that had no chance of becoming reality. Now he saw that most people expected the Act to become a reality today. He had misjudged the situation badly. Was he equally wrong to believe that something like this could not happen in his own country? Was he fooling himself? Someone asked if the Catholics had made a final decision. Lloyd stood up. "I'll find out," he said. He left and ran to the center party's meeting room. As before, he put his head around the door and beckoned Heinrich outside.
"Bröning and Ersing are wavering," Heinrich said.
Lloyd's heart sank. Ersing was a Catholic Union leader.
"How can a trade unionist even think about voting for this bill?"
he said. "Kass says the fatherland is in danger. They all think there will be bloody anarchy if we reject this act.
There'll be bloody tyranny if you pass it.
What about your lot?" "They think they will all be shot if they vote against, but they're going to do it anyway." Heinrich went back inside, and Lloyd returned to the Social Democrats. "The diehards are weakening," Lloyd told Walter and his colleagues. "They're afraid of a civil war if the act is rejected." The gloom deepened. They all returned to the debating chamber at 6 o'clock. Vels spoke first. He was calm, reasonable, and unemotional. He pointed out that life in a democratic republic had been good for Germans overall, bringing freedom of opportunity and social welfare, and reinstating Germany as a normal member of the international community. Lloyd noticed Hitler making notes. At the end, Vels bravely professed allegiance to humanity and justice, freedom, and socialism.
"No enabling law gives you the power to annihilate ideas that are eternal and indestructible," he said, gaining courage as the Nazis began to laugh and jeer.
The Social Democrats applauded, but they were drowned out.
"We greet the persecuted and oppressed," Vels shouted. "We greet our friends in the Reich. Their steadfastness and loyalty deserve admiration."
Lloyd could just make out his words over the hooting and booing of the Nazis.
"The courage of their convictions and their unbroken optimism guarantee a brighter future."
He sat down amid raucous heckling. Would the speech make any difference? Lloyd could not tell. After Vels, Hitler spoke again. This time his tone was quite different. Lloyd realized that in his earlier speech, the Chancellor had only been warming up. His voice was louder now, his phrases more intemperate, his tone full of contempt. He used his right arm constantly to make aggressive gestures, pointing, hammering, clenching his fist, putting his hand on his heart, and sweeping the air in a motion that seemed to brush all opposition aside. Every impassioned phrase was cheered uproariously by his supporters. Every sentence expressed the same emotion, a savage, all-consuming, murderous rage. Hitler was also confident. He claimed he had not needed to propose the Enabling Act.
"We appeal in this hour to the German Reichstag to grant us something we would have taken anyway," he jeered.
Heinrich looked worried and left the box. A minute later, Lloyd saw him on the floor of the auditorium, whispering in his father's ear. When he returned to the box, he looked stricken. Lloyd said, "Have you got your written assurances?" Heinrich could not meet Lloyd's eye. "The document is being typed up," he replied. Hitler finished by scorning the Social Democrats. He did not want their votes.
"Germany shall be free," he screamed, "but not through you."
The leaders of the other parties spoke briefly. Everyone appeared crushed. Prelate Kass said the center party would support the bill. The rest followed suit. Everyone but the Social Democrats was in favor. The result of the vote was announced, and the Nazis cheered wildly. Lloyd was awestruck. He had seen naked power brutally wielded, and it was an ugly sight. He left the box without speaking to Heinrich. He found Walter in the entrance lobby, weeping. He was using a large white handkerchief to wipe his face, but the tears kept coming. Lloyd had not seen men cry like that except at funerals. Lloyd did not know what to say or do.
"My life has been a failure," Walter said. "This is the end of all hope. German democracy is dead."
7. Saturday, April 1st, was Boycott Jews Day. Lloyd and Ethel walked around Berlin, staring in incredulity, Ethel making notes for her book. The Star of David was crudely daubed on the windows of Jewish-owned shops. Brown shirts stood at the doors of Jewish-owned department stores, intimidating people who wanted to go in. Jewish lawyers and doctors were picketed. Lloyd happened to see a couple of brown shirts stopping patients going in to see the von Ulrichs family physician, Dr. Rothman. But then a hard-handed coal heaver with a sprained ankle told the brown shirts to fuck off out of it, and they went in search of easier prey.
"How can people be so mean to each other?" Ethel said.
Lloyd was thinking of the stepfather he loved. Bernie Leckwith was Jewish. If fascism came to Britain, Bernie would be the target of this kind of hatred. The thought made Lloyd shudder. A sort of wake was held at Bistro Robert that evening. Apparently, no one had organized it, but by 8 o'clock the place was full of social democrats, Maud's journalistic colleagues, and Robert's theatrical friends. The more optimistic among them said that liberty had merely gone into hibernation for the duration of the economic slump, and one day it would awaken. The rest just mourned. Lloyd drank little. He did not enjoy the effect of alcohol on his brain. It blurred his thinking. He was asking himself what German left-wingers could have done to prevent this catastrophe, and he did not have an answer. Maud told them about Ada's baby, Kurt. "She's brought him home from the hospital, and he seems to be happy enough for now, but his brain is damaged and he will never be normal. When he's older, he will have to live in an institution, poor mite." Lloyd had heard how the baby had been delivered by 11-year-old Carla. That little girl had grit. Commissar Thomas Macker arrived at 9:30, wearing his brown shirt uniform. Last time he was here, Robert had treated him as a figure of fun, but Lloyd had sensed the menace of the man. He looked foolish, with a little mustache in the middle of the fat face, but there was a glint of cruelty in his eyes that made Lloyd nervous. Robert had refused to sell the restaurant. What did Macker want now? Macker stood in the middle of the dining area and shouted, "This restaurant is being used to promote degenerate behavior." The patrons went quiet, wondering what this was about. Macker raised a finger in a gesture that meant, "You'd better listen." Lloyd felt there was something horribly familiar about the action, and realized Macker was mimicking Hitler. Macker said, "Homosexuality is incompatible with the masculine character of the German nation." Lloyd frowned. Was he saying that Robert was queer? Jörg came into the restaurant from the kitchen, wearing his tall chef's hat. He stood by the door, glaring at Macker. Lloyd was struck by a shocking thought. Maybe Robert was queer. After all, he and Jörg had been living together since the war. Looking around at their theatrical friends, Lloyd noticed that they were all men in pairs, except for two women with short hair. Lloyd felt bewildered. He knew that queers existed, and as a broad-minded person he believed they should not be persecuted but helped. However, he thought of them as perverts and creeps. Robert and Jörg seemed like normal men, running a business and living quietly, almost like a married couple. He turned to his mother and said quietly, "Are Robert and Jörg really—" "Yes, dear," she said. Maud, sitting next to her, said, "Robert in his youth was a menace to footmen." Both women giggled. Lloyd was doubly shocked. Not only was Robert queer, but Ethel and Maud thought it a matter for light-hearted banter. Macker said, "This establishment is now closed." Robert said, "You have no right." Macker could not close the place on his own, Lloyd thought. Then he remembered how the brown shirts had crowded onto the stage at the People's Theatre. He looked toward the entrance, and was aghast to see brown shirts pushing through the door. They went around the tables, knocking over bottles and glasses. Some customers sat motionless and watched, others got to their feet. Several men shouted and a woman screamed. Walter stood up and spoke loudly but calmly. "We should all leave quietly," he said. "There's no need for any rough stuff. Everybody just get your coats and hats and go home." The customers began to leave, some trying to get their coats, others just fleeing. Walter and Lloyd ushered Maud and Ethel toward the door. The till was near the exit, and Lloyd saw Brownshirt open it and begin stuffing money into his pockets. Until then, Robert had been standing still, watching miserably as a night's business hurried out of the door. But this was too much. He gave a shout of protest and shoved the brown shirt away from the till. The brown shirt punched him, knocking him to the floor, and began to kick him as he lay there. Another brown shirt joined in. Lloyd leaped to Robert's rescue. He heard his mother shout, "No!" as he shoved the brown shirt aside. Jörg was almost as quick, and the two of them bent to help Robert up. They were immediately attacked by several more brown shirts. Lloyd was punched and kicked, and something heavy hit him over the head, and as he cried out in pain, he thought, "No, not again." He turned on his attackers, punching with his left and right, making every blow connect hard, trying to punch through the target, as he had been taught. He knocked two men down. Then he was grabbed from behind and thrown off balance. A moment later he was on the floor, with two men holding him down while a third kicked him. Then he was rolled over onto his front. His arms were pulled behind his back, and he felt metal on his wrists. He had been handcuffed for the first time in his life. He felt a new kind of fear. This was not just another roughhouse. He had been beaten and kicked, but worse was in store. "Get up," someone told him in German. He struggled to his feet. His head hurt. Robert and Jörg were also in handcuffs, he saw. Robert's mouth was bleeding and Jörg had one closed eye. Half a dozen brown shirts were guarding them. The rest were drinking from the glasses and bottles left on the tables, or standing at the dessert cart stuffing their faces with pastries. All the customers seemed to have gone. Lloyd felt relieved that his mother had got away. The restaurant door opened and Walter came back in. "Kommissar Macker," he said, displaying a typical politician's facility for remembering names. With as much authority as he could muster, he said, "What is the meaning of this outrage?" Macker pointed to Robert and Jörg. "These two men are homosexuals," he said, "and that boy attacked an auxiliary policeman who was arresting them." Walter pointed to the till, which was open, its drawer sticking out and empty except for a few small coins. "Do police officers commit robbery nowadays?" "A customer must have taken advantage of the confusion created by those resisting arrest." Some of the brown shirts laughed knowingly. Walter said, "You used to be a law enforcement officer, didn't you, Macker? You might have been proud of yourself once. But what are you now?" Macker was stung. "We enforce order to protect the fatherland." "Where are you planning to take your prisoners, Ivanter?" Walter persisted. "Will it be a properly constituted place of detention, or some half-hidden unofficial basement?"
"They will be taken to the Friedrichstrasse Barracks," Marcus said indignantly.
Lloyd saw a look of satisfaction pass briefly across Walter's face, and realized Walter had cleverly manipulated Marcus, playing on whatever was left of his professional pride, in order to get him to reveal his intentions. Now, at least, Walter knew where Lloyd and the others were being taken. But what would happen at the barracks? Lloyd had never been arrested. However, he lived in the East End of London, so he knew plenty of people who got into trouble with the police. Most of his life, he had played street football with boys whose fathers were arrested frequently. He knew the reputation of Leman Street Police Station in Aldgate. Few men came out of that building uninjured. People said there was blood all over the walls. Was it likely that Friedrichstrasse Barracks would be any better? Walter said, "This is an international incident, Kommissar." Lloyd guessed he was using the title in the hope of making Macker behave more like an officer, and less like a thug. "You have arrested three foreign citizens, two Austrians and one Englishman." He held up a hand as if to fend off a protest. "It is too late to back out now. Both embassies are being informed, and I have no doubt that their representatives will be knocking on the door of our foreign office in Wilhelmstrasse within the hour." Lloyd wondered whether that was true. Macker grinned unpleasantly.
"The foreign office will not hasten to defend two queers and a young hooligan."
"Our foreign minister, Van Neurath, is not a member of your party," Walter said. "He may well put the interests of the fatherland first."
"I think you will find that he does what he's told. And now you are obstructing me in the course of my duty."
"I warn you," Walter said bravely, "you had better follow procedure by the book.
or there will be trouble.
Get out of my sight, said Marker.
Walter left. Lloyd, Robert, and Jörg were marched outside and bundled into the back of some kind of truck. They were forced to lie on the floor while Brownshirt sat on benches guarding them. The vehicle moved off. It was painful being handcuffed, Lloyd discovered. He felt constantly that his shoulder was about to become dislocated. The trip was mercifully short. They were shoved out of the truck and into a building. It was dark, and Lloyd saw little. At a desk, his name was written in a book and his passport was taken away. Robert lost his gold tie-pin and watch chain. At last the handcuffs were removed and they were pushed into a room with dim lights and barred windows. There were about 40 other prisoners there already. Lloyd hurt all over. He had a pain in his chest that felt like a cracked rib. His face was bruised and he had a blinding headache. He wanted an aspirin, a cup of tea, and a pillow. He had a feeling it might be some hours before he got any of those things. The three of them sat on the floor near the door. Lloyd held his head in his hands while Robert and Jörg discussed how soon help would come. No doubt Walter would phone a lawyer. But all the usual rules had been suspended by the Reichstag fire decree, so they had no proper protection under the law. Walter would also contact the embassies. Political influence was their main hope now. Lloyd thought his mother would probably try to place an international phone call to the British Foreign Office in London. If she could get through, the government would surely have something to say about the arrest of a British schoolboy. It would all take time, an hour at least, probably two or three. But 4 hours passed, then five, and the door did not open. Civilized countries had a law about how long the police could keep someone in custody without formalities, a charge, a lawyer, a court. Lloyd now realized that such a rule was no mere technicality. He could be here forever. The other prisoners in the room were all political, he discovered. Communists, social democrats, trade union organizers, and one priest. The night passed slowly. None of the three slept. To Lloyd, sleep seemed unthinkable. The gray light of morning was coming through the barred windows when at last the cell door opened. But no lawyers or diplomats came in, just two men in aprons pushing a trolley on which stood a large urn. They ladled out a thin oatmeal. Lloyd did not eat any, but he drank a tin mug of coffee that tasted of burned barley. He surmised that the staff on duty overnight at the British Embassy were junior diplomats who carried little weight. This morning, as soon as the ambassador himself got up, action would be taken. An hour after breakfast, the door opened again. But this time only Brownshirt stood there. They marched all the prisoners out and loaded them onto a truck, 40 or 50 men in one canvas-sided vehicle, packed so tightly that they had to remain standing. Lloyd managed to stay close to Robert and Jörg. Perhaps they were going to court, even though it was Sunday. He hoped so. At least there would be lawyers, and some semblance of due process. He thought he was fluent enough to state his simple case in German, and he practiced his speech in his head. He had been dining in a restaurant with his mother, he had seen someone robbing the till, he had intervened in the resulting fracas. He imagined his cross-examination. He would be asked if the man he attacked was a brown shirt. He would answer, "I didn't notice his clothing, I just saw a thief." There would be laughter in court and the prosecutor would look foolish. They were driven out of town. They could see through gaps in the canvas sides of the truck. It seemed to Lloyd that they had gone about 20 miles, when Robert said, "We in Oranienburg," naming a small town north of Berlin. The truck came to a halt outside a wooden gate between brick pillars. Two brown shirts with rifles stood guard. Lloyd's fear rose a notch. Where was the court? This looked more like a prison camp. How could they put people in prison without a judge? After a short wait, the truck drove in and stopped at a group of derelict buildings. Lloyd was becoming even more anxious. Last night, he at least had the consolation that Walter knew where he was. Today it was possible no one would know. What if the police simply said he was not in custody and they had no record of his arrest? How could he be rescued? They got out of the truck and shuffled into what looked like a factory of some sort. The place smelled like a pub. Perhaps it had been a brewery. Once again, all their names were taken. Lloyd was glad there was some record of his movements. They were not tied up or handcuffed, but they were constantly watched by brown shirts with rifles, and Lloyd had a grim feeling that those young men were only too eager for an excuse to shoot. They were each given a canvas mattress filled with straw and a thin blanket. They were herded into a tumble-down building that might once have been a warehouse. Then the waiting began. No one came for Lloyd all that day. In the evening there was another trolley and another urn, this one containing a stew of carrots and turnips. Each man got a bowlful and a piece of bread. Lloyd was now ravenous, not having eaten for 24 hours, and he wolfed his meager supper and wished for more. Somewhere in the camp there were 3 or 4 dogs that howled all night. Lloyd felt dirty. This was the second night he had spent in the same clothes. He needed a bath and a shave and a clean shirt. The toilet facilities, 2 barrels in the corner, were absolutely disgusting. But tomorrow was Monday. Then there would be some action. Lloyd fell asleep around 4. At 6 they were awakened by a brown shirt bawling,
"Schleicher! Jörg Schleicher! Which one is Schleicher?"
Maybe they were going to be released. Jörg stood up and said,
"Me. I'm Schleicher."
"Come with me," said the brown shirt.
Robert said in a frightened voice,
"Why? What do you want him for? Where is he going?"
"What are you? His mother?" said the brown shirt. "Lie down and shut your mouth."
He poked Jörg with his rifle. "Outside, you." Watching them go, Lloyd asked himself why he had not punched the brown shirt and snatched the rifle. He might have escaped. And if he had failed, what would they do to him? Throw him in jail? But at the crucial moment the thought of escape had not even occurred to him. Was he already taking on the mentality of the prisoner? He was even looking forward to the oatmeal. Before breakfast, they were all taken outside. They stood around a small wire-fenced area a quarter the size of a tennis court. It looked as if it might have been used to store something not very valuable, timber or tires, perhaps. Lloyd shivered in the cold morning air. His overcoat was still at Bistro Robert. Then he saw Thomas Marker approaching. The police detective wore a black coat over his brown shirt uniform. He had a heavy, flat-footed stride, Lloyd noticed. Behind Marker were 2 brown shirts holding the arms of a naked man with a bucket over his head. Lloyd stared in horror. The prisoner's hands were tied behind his back, and the bucket was tightly tied with string under his chin, so that it would not fall off. He was a slight, youngish man with blonde pubic hair. Robert groaned. "Oh, sweet Jesus. It's Jörg." All the brown shirts in the camp had gathered. Lloyd frowned. What was this? Some kind of cruel game? Jörg was led into the fenced compound and left there, shivering. His 2 escorts withdrew. They disappeared for a few minutes, then returned, each of them leading 2 Alsatian dogs. That explained the all-night barking. The dogs were thin, with unhealthy bald patches in their tan fur. They looked starved. The brown shirts led them to the fenced compound. Lloyd had a vague but dreadful premonition of what was to come. Robert screamed,
"No!"
He ran forward.
"No, no, no!"
He tried to open the gate of the compound. 3 or 4 brown shirts pulled him away roughly. He struggled, but they were strong young thugs, and Robert was approaching 50 years old. He could not resist them. They threw him contemptuously to the ground.
"No," said Marker to his men, "make him watch."
They lifted Robert to his feet and held him facing the wire fence. The dogs were led into the compound. They were excited, barking and slavering. The 2 brown shirts handled them expertly and without fear, clearly experienced. Lloyd wondered dismally how many times they had done this before. The handlers released the dogs and hurried out of the compound. The dogs dashed for Jörg. One bit his calf, another his arm, a third his thigh. From behind the metal bucket there was a muffled scream of agony and terror. The brown shirts cheered and applauded. The prisoners looked on in mute horror. After the first shock, Jörg tried to defend himself. His hands were tied and he was unable to see, but he could kick out randomly. However, his bare feet made little impact on the starving dogs. They dodged and came again, ripping his flesh with their sharp teeth. He tried running. With the dogs at his heels, he ran blindly in a straight line until he crashed into the wire fence. The brown shirts cheered raucously. Jörg ran in a different direction with the same result. A dog took a chunk out of Jörg's behind, and they hooted with laughter. A brown shirt standing next to Lloyd was shouting, "His tail! Bite his tail!" Lloyd guessed that tail in German, der Schwanz, was slang for penis. The man was hysterical with excitement. Jörg's white body was now running with blood from multiple wounds. He pressed himself up against the wire, face first, protecting his genitals, kicking out backward and sideways. But he was weakening. His kicks became feeble. He was having trouble staying upright. The dogs became bolder, tearing at him and swallowing bloody chunks. At last, Jörg slid to the ground. The dogs settled down to feed. The handlers re-entered the compound. With practiced motions, they reattached the dogs' leashes, pulled them off Jörg, and led them away. The show was over, and the brown shirts began to move away, chattering excitedly. Robert ran into the compound, and this time no one stopped him. He bent over Jörg, moaning. Lloyd helped them untie Jörg's hands and remove the bucket. Jörg was unconscious but breathing. Lloyd said, "Let's get him indoors. You take his legs." Lloyd grasped Jörg under the arms, and the two of them carried him into the building where they had slept. They put him on a mattress. The other prisoners gathered around, frightened and subdued. Lloyd hoped one of them might announce that he was a doctor, but no one did. Robert stripped off his jacket and waistcoat, then took off his shirt and used it to wipe the blood. "We need clean water," he said. There was a standpipe in the yard. Lloyd went out, but he had no container. He returned to the compound. The bucket was still there on the ground. He washed it out, then filled it with water. When he returned, the mattress was soaked in blood. Robert dipped his shirt in the bucket and continued to wash Jörg's wounds, kneeling beside the mattress. Soon the white shirt was red. Jörg stirred. Robert spoke to him in a low voice.
"Be calm, my beloved," he said. "It's over now, and I'm here."
But Jörg seemed not to hear. Then Maka came in, with four or five brown shirts following. He grabbed Robert's arm and pulled him.
"So," he said, "now you know what we think of homosexual perverts."
Lloyd pointed at Jörg and said angrily, "The pervert is the one who caused this to happen." Mustering all his rage and contempt, he said, "Commissar Maka." Maka gave a slight nod to one of the brown shirts. In a movement that was deceptively casual, the man reversed his rifle and hit Lloyd over the head with the butt. Lloyd fell to the ground, holding his head in agony. He heard Robert say, "Please, just let me look after Jörg."
"Perhaps," said Maka. "First, come over here."
Despite his pain, Lloyd opened his eyes to see what was happening. Maka pulled Robert across the room to a rough wooden table. From his pocket he drew a document and a fountain pen.
"Your restaurant is now worth half of what I last offered you. 10,000 marks.
"Anything?" said Robert, weeping. "Leave me to be with Jörg."
"Sign here," said Maka. "Then the three of you can go home."
Robert signed.
"This gentleman can be a witness," Maka said.
He gave the pen to one of the brown shirts. He looked across the room and met Lloyd's eye.
"And perhaps our foolhardy English guest can be the second witness."
Robert said,
"Just do what he wants, Lloyd."
Lloyd struggled to his feet, rubbed his sore head, took the pen and signed. Maka pocketed the contract triumphantly and went out. Robert and Lloyd returned to Jörg. But Jörg was dead. 8. Walter and Maud came to the Leotta station, just north of the burned-out Reichstag, to see Ethel and Lloyd off. The station building was in the neo-Renaissance style and looked like a French palace. They were early, and they sat in a station café while they waited for the train. Lloyd was glad to be leaving. In 6 weeks he had learned a lot, about the German language and about politics, but now he wanted to get home, tell people what he had seen, and warn them against the same thing happening to them. All the same, he felt strangely guilty about departing. He was going to a place where the law ruled, the press was free, and it was not a crime to be a social democrat. He was leaving the von Ulrich family to live on in a cruel dictatorship, where an innocent man could be torn to pieces by dogs, and no one would ever be brought to justice for the crime. The von Ulrichs looked crushed, Walter even more than Maud. They were like people who had heard bad news, or suffered a death in the family. They seemed unable to think much about anything other than the catastrophe that had happened to them. Lloyd had been released with profuse apologies from the German Foreign Ministry, and an explanatory statement that was abject, yet at the same time mendacious, implying that he had got into a brawl through his own foolishness and then been held prisoner by an administrative error, for which the authorities were deeply sorry. Walter said, "I've had a telegram from Robert. He's arrived safely in London." As an Austrian citizen, Robert had been able to leave Germany without much difficulty. Getting his money out had been more tricky. Walter had demanded that Marker pay the money to a bank in Switzerland. At first, Marker had said that was impossible, but Walter had put pressure on him, threatening to challenge the sale in court, saying that Lloyd was prepared to testify that the contract had been signed under duress, and in the end, Marker had pulled some strings. "I'm glad Robert got out," Lloyd said. "He would be even happier when he himself was safe in London. His head was still tender, and he got a pain in his ribs every time he turned over in bed." Ethel said to Maud, "Why don't you come to London? Both of you. The whole family, I mean." Walter looked at Maud. "Perhaps we should," he said, but Lloyd could tell that he did not really mean it. "You've done your best," Ethel said. "You've fought bravely, but the other side won." Maud said, "It's not over yet." "But you're in danger. So is Germany. If you came to live in London, Fitz might soften his attitude and help you."
Earl Fitzherbert was one of the wealthiest men in Britain, Lloyd knew, because of the coal mines beneath his land in South Wales.
"He wouldn't help me," Maud said. "Fitz doesn't relent. I know that, and so do you."
"You're right," Ethel said.
Lloyd wondered how she could be so sure, but he did not get a chance to ask. Ethel went on, "Well, you could easily get a job on a London newspaper with your experience." Walter said, "And what would I do in London?"
"I don't know," Ethel said. "What are you going to do here? There's not much point in being an elected representative in an impotent parliament."
She was being brutally frank, Lloyd felt, but characteristically she was saying what had to be said. Lloyd sympathized, but felt the von Ulrichs should stay.
"I know it will be hard," Walter said, "but if decent people flee from fascism, it will spread all the faster."
"It's spreading anyway," Ethel rejoined.
Maud startled them all by saying vehemently, "I will not go. I absolutely refuse to leave Germany." They all stared at her.
"I'm German, and have been for 14 years, she said. "This is my country now."
"But you were born English," said Ethel.
"A country is mostly the people in it," Maud said. "I don't love England. My parents died a long time ago, and my brother has disowned me. I love Germany. For me, Germany is my wonderful husband, Walter, my misguided son, Eric, my alarmingly capable daughter, Carla, our maid, Ada, and her disabled son, my friend, Monica, and her family, my journalistic colleagues. I'm staying to fight the Nazis."
"You've already done more than your share," Ethel said gently.
Maud's tone became emotional.
"My husband has dedicated himself, his life, his entire being to making this country free and prosperous. I will not be the cause of his giving up his life's work. If he loses that, he loses his soul."
Ethel pushed the point in a way that only an old friend could.
"Still," she said, "there must be a temptation to take your children to safety."
"A temptation? You mean a longing, a yearning, a desperate desire?" She began to cry.
"Carla has nightmares about brown shirts, and Eric puts on that shit-colored uniform every chance he gets."
Lloyd was startled by her fervor. He had never heard a respectable woman say shit. She went on,
"Of course I want to take them away."
Lloyd could see how torn she was. She rubbed her hands together as if washing them, turned her head from side to side in distraction, and spoke in a voice that shook violently with her inner conflict.
But it's the wrong thing to do, for them as well as for us. I will not give in to it. Better to suffer evil than stand by and do nothing.
Ethel touched Maud's arm. I'm sorry I asked. Perhaps it was silly of me. I might have known you wouldn't run away.
I'm glad you asked, Walter said.
He reached out and took Maud's slim hands in his own. The question has been hanging in the air between Maud and me, unspoken. It was time we faced it. Their joined hands rested on the cafe table. Lloyd rarely thought about the emotional lives of his mother's generation. They were middle-aged and married, and that seemed to say it all. But now he saw that between Walter and Maud, there was a powerful connection that was much more than the familiar habit of a mature marriage. They were under no illusions. They knew that by staying here they were risking their lives and the lives of their children, but they had a shared commitment that defied death. Lloyd wondered whether he would ever have such a love. Ethel looked at the clock.
Oh, my goodness, she said. We're going to miss the train.
Lloyd picked up their bags and they hurried across the platform. A whistle blew. They boarded the train just in time. They both leaned out of the window as it pulled out of the station. Walter and Maud stood on the platform, waving, getting smaller and smaller in the distance, until finally they disappeared. Chapter 2 1935.
Two things you need to know about girls in Buffalo, said Daisy Peshkov. They drink like fish, and they're all snobs.
Eva Rothman giggled.
I don't believe you, she said.
Her German accent had almost completely vanished.
Oh, it's true, said Daisy.
They were in her pink and white bedroom trying on clothes in front of a full-length three-way mirror.
Navy and white might look good on you, Daisy said. What do you think?
She held a blouse up to Ava's face and studied the effect. The contrasting colors seemed to suit her. Daisy was looking through her closet for an outfit Ava could wear to the beach picnic. Ava was not a pretty girl, and the frills and bows that decorated many of Daisy's clothes only made Ava look frumpy. Stripes better suited her strong features. Ava's hair was dark, and her eyes deep brown.
You can wear bright colors, Daisy told her.
Ava had few clothes of her own. Her father, a Jewish doctor in Berlin, had spent his life savings to send her to America, and she had arrived a year ago with nothing. A charity paid for her to go to Daisy's boarding school. They were the same age, 19. But Ava had nowhere to go in the summer vacation, so Daisy had impulsively invited her home. At first, Daisy's mother, Olga, had resisted.
Oh, but you're away at school all year. I so look forward to having you to myself in the summer.
She's really great, Mother, Daisy had said. She's charming and easygoing and a loyal friend.
I suppose you feel sorry for her because she's a refugee from the Nazis.
I don't care about the Nazis. I just like her.
That's fine. But does she have to live with us?
Mother, she has nowhere else to go.
As usual, Olga let Daisy have her way in the end. Now Ava said,
Snobs? No one would be snobby to you?
Oh, yes, they would.
But you're so pretty and vivacious.
Daisy did not bother to deny it.
They hate that about me.
And you're rich?
It was true. Daisy's father was wealthy. Her mother had inherited a fortune. And Daisy herself would come into money when she was 21.
It doesn't mean a thing. In this town it's about how long you've been rich. You're nobody if you work. The superior people are those who live on the millions left by the great-grandparents.
She spoke in a tone of gay mockery to hide the resentment she felt.
Ava said, And your father is famous.
They think he's a gangster.
Daisy's grandfather, Josef Vyalov, had owned bars and hotels. Her father, Lev Peshkov, had used the profits to buy ailing vaudeville theaters and convert them into cinemas. Now he owned a Hollywood studio, too. Ava was indignant on Daisy's behalf.
How can they say such a thing?
They believe he was a bootlegger. They're probably right. I can't see how else he made money out of bars during Prohibition. Anyway, that's why Mother will never be invited to join the Buffalo Ladies' Society.
They both looked at Olga, sitting on Daisy's bed, reading the Buffalo Sentinel.
In photographs taken when she was young, Olga was a willowy beauty. Now she was dumpy and drab. She had lost interest in her appearance, though she shopped energetically with Daisy, never caring how much she spent to make her daughter look fabulous. Olga looked up from the newspaper to say, "I'm not sure they mind your father being a bootlegger, dear, but he's a Russian immigrant, and on the rare occasions he decides to attend divine service, he goes to the Russian Orthodox Church on Ideal Street. That's almost as bad as being Catholic." Ava said, "It's so unfair." "I might as well warn you that they're not too fond of Jews either," Daisy said. Ava was, in fact, half-Jewish.
"Sorry to be blunt."
"Be as blunt as you like. After Germany, this country feels like the promised land." "Don't get too comfortable," Olga warned her. "According to this paper, plenty of American business leaders hate President Roosevelt and admire Adolf Hitler. I know that's true because Daisy's father is one of them."
"Politics is boring," said Daisy. "Isn't there something interesting in the Sentinel?"
"Yes, there is. Muffy Dixon is to be presented at the British court."
"Good for her,"
Daisy said sourly, failing to conceal her envy. Olga read, "Miss Muriel Dixon, daughter of the late Charles Chuck Dixon, who was killed in France during the war, will be presented at Buckingham Palace next Tuesday by the wife of the United States Ambassador, Mrs. Robert W. Bingham." Daisy had heard enough about Muffy Dixon. "I've been to Paris, but never London," she said to Ava.
"What about you?"
"Neither," said Ava. "The first time I left Germany was when I sailed to America." Olga suddenly said, "Oh dear."
"What's happened?"
Daisy said. Her mother crumpled the paper. "Your father took Gladys Angelus to the White House."
"Oh!"
Daisy felt as if she had been slapped.
"But he said he would take me."
President Roosevelt had invited 100 businessmen to a reception in an attempt to win them over to his New Deal. Lev Peshkov thought Franklin D. Roosevelt was the next thing to a communist, but he had been flattered to be asked to the White House. However, Olga had refused to accompany him, saying angrily, "I'm not willing to pretend to the president that we have a normal marriage." Lev officially lived here, in the stylish pre-war prairie home built by Grandfather Vyolov, but he spent more nights at the swanky downtown apartment, where he kept his mistress of many years, Marga. On top of that, everyone assumed he was having an affair with his studio's biggest star, Gladys Angelus. Daisy understood why her mother felt spurned. Daisy, too, felt rejected when Lev drove off to spend his evenings with his other family. She had been thrilled when he asked her to accompany him to the White House instead of her mother. She had told everyone she was going. None of her friends had met the president, except the Dewar boys, whose father was a senator. Lev had not told her the exact date, and she assumed he would let her know at the last minute, which was his usual style. But he had changed his mind, or perhaps just forgotten. Either way, he had rejected Daisy again.
"I'm sorry, honey," said her mother, "but promises never did mean much to your father."
Ava was looking sympathetic. Her pity stung Daisy. Ava's father was thousands of miles away, and she might never see him again. But she felt sorry for Daisy, as if Daisy's plight was worse. It made Daisy feel defiant. She would not let this ruin her day. "Well, I'll be the only girl in Buffalo who has been stood up for Gladys Angelus," she said.
"Now, what shall I wear?"
Skirts were dramatically short this year in Paris, but the conservative Buffalo set followed fashion at a distance. However, Daisy had a knee-length tennis dress in a shade of baby blue the same as her eyes. Maybe today was the day to bring it out. She slipped off her dress and put on the new one.
"What do you think?"
she said.
Ava said, "Oh, Daisy, it's beautiful, but..."
Olga said, "That'll make their eyes pop." Olga liked it when Daisy dressed to kill. Perhaps it reminded her of her youth. Ava said,
"Daisy, if they're all so snobbish, why do you want to go to the party?"
"Charlie Farquharson will be there, and I'm thinking of marrying him," Daisy said.
"Are you serious?"
Olga said emphatically, "He's a great catch." Ava said,
"What's he like?"
"Absolutely adorable," Daisy said. "Not the handsomest boy in Buffalo, but sweet and kind, and rather shy."
He sounds very different from you.
It's the attraction of opposites.
Olga spoke again. The Farquharsons are among the oldest families in Buffalo. Ava raised her dark eyebrows.
Snobby?
Very,
Daisy said. But Charlie's father lost all his money in the Wall Street crash, then died. Killed himself, some say. So they need to restore the family fortunes.
Ava looked shocked. You're hoping he'll marry you for your money?
No. He'll marry me because I will bewitch him. But his mother will accept me for my money.
You say you will bewitch him?
Does he know about any of this?
Not yet, but I think I might make a start this afternoon.
Yes, this is definitely the right dress.
Daisy wore the baby blue and Ava the navy and white stripes. By the time they got ready, they were late. Daisy's mother would not have a chauffeur. I married my father's chauffeur and it ruined my life, she sometimes said. She was terrified Daisy might do something similar. That was why she was so keen on Charlie Farquharson. If she needed to go anywhere in her creaking 1925 Stutz, she made Henry, the gardener, take off his rubber boots and put on a black suit. But Daisy had her own car, a red Chevrolet Sport Coupe. Daisy liked driving, loved the power and speed of it. They headed south out of the city. She was almost sorry it was only 5 or 6 miles to the beach. As she drove, she thought about life as Charlie's wife. With her money and his status, they would become the leading couple in Buffalo society. At their dinner parties, the table settings would be so elegant that people would gasp in delight. They would have the biggest yacht in the harbor and throw onboard parties for other wealthy, fun-loving couples. People would yearn for an invitation from Mrs. Charles Farquharson. No charity function would be a success without Daisy and Charlie at the top table. In her head, she watched a movie of herself in a ravishing Paris gown, walking through a crowd of admiring men and women, smiling graciously at their compliments. She was still daydreaming when they reached their destination. The city of Buffalo was in upstate New York, near the Canadian border. Woodlawn Beach was a mile of sand on the shore of Lake Erie. Daisy parked and they walked across the dunes. 50 or 60 people were already there. These were the adolescent children of the Buffalo elite, a privileged group who spent their summers sailing and water skiing in the daytime and going to parties and dances at night. Daisy greeted the people she knew, which was just about everyone, and introduced Ava around. They got glasses of punch. Daisy tasted it cautiously. Some of the boys would think it hilarious to spike the drink with a couple of bottles of gin. The party was for Dot Renshaw, a sharp-tongued girl whom no one wanted to marry. The Renshaws were an old Buffalo family, like the Farquharsons, but their fortune had survived the crash. Daisy made sure to approach the host, Dot's father, and thank him.
I'm sorry we're late, she said. I lost track of time.
Philip Renshaw looked her up and down. That's a very short skirt. Disapproval vied with lasciviousness in his expression.
I'm so glad you like it,
Daisy replied, pretending he had paid her a straightforward compliment. Anyway, it's good that you're here at last, he went on. A photographer from the Sentinel is coming, and we must have some pretty girls in the picture. Daisy muttered to Ava,
so that's why I was invited. How kind of him to let me know.
Dot came up. She had a thin face with a pointed nose. Daisy always thought she looked as if she might peck you.
I thought you were going with your father to meet the president, she said.
Daisy felt mortified. She wished she had not boasted to everyone about this.
I see he took his, leading lady, Dot went on. Unusual, that sort of thing, in the White House.
Daisy said, I guess the president likes to meet movie stars occasionally. He deserves a little glamour, don't you think?
I can't imagine Eleanor Roosevelt approved. According to the Sentinel, all the other men took their wives.
How thoughtful of them. Daisy turned away, desperate to escape. She spotted Charlie Farquharson, trying to erect a net for beach tennis. He was too good-natured to mock her about Gladys Angelus.
How are you, Charlie?
She said brightly. Fine, I guess. He stood up, a tall man of about 25, a little overweight, stooping slightly as if he feared his height might be intimidating.
Daisy introduced Ava. Charlie was sweetly awkward in company, especially with girls, but he made an effort and asked Ava how she liked America and what she heard from her family back in Berlin. Ava asked him if he was enjoying the picnic.
Not much, he said candidly. I'd rather be at home with my dogs.
No doubt he found pets easier to deal with than girls, Daisy thought, but the mention of dogs was interesting.
What kind of dogs do you have? She asked.
Jack Russell Terriers. Daisy made a mental note. An angular woman of about 50 approached.
For goodness sake, Charlie, haven't you got that net up yet?
Almost there, Mom, he said. Nora Farquharson was wearing a gold tennis bracelet, diamond ear studs, and a Tiffany necklace, more jewelry than she really needed for a picnic. The Farquharsons' poverty was relative, Daisy reflected. They said they had lost everything, but Mrs. Farquharson still had a maid and a chauffeur and a couple of horses for riding in the park. Daisy said, "Good afternoon, Mrs. Farquharson. This is my friend Ava Rothman from Berlin."
"How do you do?"
said Nora Farquharson without offering her hand. She felt no need to be friendly toward Arivist Russians, much less their Jewish guests. Then she seemed to be struck by a thought.
"Ah, Daisy, you could go around and find out who wants to play tennis."
Daisy knew she was being treated somewhat as a servant, but she decided to be compliant.
"Of course," she said. "Makes doubles, I suggest."
"Good idea." Mrs. Farquharson held out a pencil stub and a scrap of paper.
"Write the names down."
Daisy smiled sweetly and took a gold pen and a little beige leather notebook from her bag.
"I'm equipped."
She knew who the tennis players were, good and bad. She belonged to the racket club, which was not as exclusive as the yacht club. She paired Ava with Chuck Duer, the 14-year-old son of Senator Duer. She put Joanne Ruzrock with the older Duer boy, Woody, only 15 but already as tall as his beanpole father. Naturally, she herself would be Charlie's partner. Daisy was startled to come across a somewhat familiar face and recognize her half-brother, Greg, the son of Marga. They did not meet often, and she had not seen him for a year. In that time, he seemed to have become a man. He was 6 inches taller, and although still only 15, he had the dark shadow of a beard. As a child, he had been disheveled, and that had not changed. He wore his expensive clothes carelessly. The sleeves of the blazer rolled up, the striped tie loose at the neck, the linen pants sea-wet and sandy at the cuffs. Daisy was always embarrassed to run into Greg. He was a living reminder of how their father had rejected Daisy and her mother in favor of Greg and Marga. Many married men had affairs, she knew, but her father's indiscretion showed up at parties for everyone to see. Father should have moved Marga and Greg to New York, where nobody knew anybody, or to California, where no one saw anything wrong with adultery. Here they were a permanent scandal, and Greg was part of the reason people looked down on Daisy. He asked her politely how she was, and she answered, "Angry as heck if you want to know. Father's let me down. Again." Greg said guardedly, "What did he do?"
"Asked me to go to the White House with him, then took that tart, Gladys Angelus. Now everyone's laughing at me."
"It must have been good publicity for Passion, a new film."
"You always take his side because he prefers you to me."
Greg looked irritated.
"Maybe that's because I admire him instead of complaining about him all the time."
"I don't."
Daisy was about to deny complaining all the time when she realized it was true.
"Well, maybe I do complain, but he should keep his promises, shouldn't he?"
"He has so much on his mind."
"Maybe he shouldn't have two mistresses as well as a wife."
Greg shrugged. "It's a lot to handle." They both noticed the unintentional double entendre, and after a moment, they giggled. Daisy said,
"Well, I guess I shouldn't blame you. You didn't ask to be born."
"And I should probably forgive you for taking my father away from me 3 nights a week, no matter how I cried and begged him to stay."
Daisy had never thought of it that way. In her mind, Greg was the usurper, the illegitimate child who kept stealing her father.
but now she realized he felt as hurt as she did. She stared at him. Some girls might find him attractive, she guessed. He was too young for Ava, though, and he would probably turn out as selfish and unreliable as their father.
Anyway, she said, do you play tennis?
He shook his head. They don't let people like me into the racket club. He forced an insouciant grin, and Daisy realized that, like her, Greg felt rejected by Buffalo's society. Ice hockey's my sport, he said.
Too bad.
She moved on. When she had enough names, she returned to Charlie, who had finally got the net up. She sent Ava to round up the first foursome. Then she said to Charlie,
help me make a competition tree.
They knelt side by side and drew a diagram in the sand with heats, semifinals, and a final. While they were entering the names, Charlie said,
do you like the movies?
Daisy wondered if he was about to ask her for a date.
Sure, she said.
Have you seen Passion by any chance?
No, Charlie, I haven't seen it, she said in a tone of exasperation. It stars my father's mistress.
He was shocked.
The papers say they're just good friends.
And why do you think Miss Angelus, who is barely 20, is so friendly with my 40-year-old father?
Daisy asked sarcastically.
Do you think she likes his receding hairline, or his little paunch, or his $50 million?
Oh, I see, said Charlie, looking abashed. Sorry.
You shouldn't be sorry. I'm being kind of bitchy. You're not like everyone else. You don't automatically think the worst of people.
I guess I'm just dumb.
No, you're just nice.
Charlie looked embarrassed, but pleased.
Let's get on with this, Daisy said. We have to rig it so the best players get through to the final.
Nora Farquharson reappeared. She looked at Charlie and Daisy kneeling side by side in the sand and studied their drawing. Charlie said, pretty good, ma'am, don't you think? He longed for approval from her. That was obvious.
Very good.
She gave Daisy an appraising look, like a mother dog seeing a stranger approach her puppies.
Charlie did most of it, Daisy said.
No, he didn't, Mrs. Farquharson said bluntly. Her gaze went to Charlie and back.
You're a smart girl, she said.
She looked as if she were about to add something, but hesitated.
What?
Said Daisy.
Nothing.
She turned away. Daisy stood up.
I know what she was thinking,
she murmured to Ava.
What? You're a smart girl, almost good enough for my son if you came from a better family.
Ava was skeptical.
You can't know that.
I sure can, and I'll marry him if only to prove his mother wrong.
Oh, Daisy, why do you care so much what these people think?
Let's watch the tennis.
Daisy sat on the sand beside Charlie. He might not have been handsome, but he would worship his wife and do anything for her. The mother-in-law would be a problem, but Daisy thought she could handle her. Tall Joanne Ruzork was serving, in a white skirt that flattered her long legs. Her partner, Woody Doer, who was even taller, handed her a tennis ball. Something in the way he looked at Joanne made Daisy think he was attracted to her, maybe even in love with her. But he was 15 and she 18, so there was no future in that. She turned to Charlie.
Maybe I should see Passion after all, she said.
He did not take the hint.
Maybe you should,
he said indifferently. The moment had passed. Daisy turned to Ava.
I wonder where I could buy a Jack Russell Terrier.
2. Lev Peshkov was the best father a guy could have, or at least he would have been if he had been around more. He was rich and generous. He was smarter than anybody. He was even well-dressed. He had probably been handsome when younger, and even now women threw themselves at him. Greg Peshkov adored him, and his only complaint was that he did not see enough of him.
I should have sold this fucking foundry when I had the chance, Lev said as they walked around the silent, deserted factory. It was losing money even before the goddamn strike. I should stick to cinemas and bars.
He wagged a didactic finger.
People always buy booze, in good times and bad. And they go to the movies even when they can't afford to. Never forget that.
Greg was pretty sure his father did not often make mistakes in business.
So why did you keep it? He said.
Sentiment, Lev replied. When I was your age, I worked in a place like this, the Putilov Machine Works in St. Petersburg.
He looked around at the furnaces, molds, hoists, lathes, and workbenches.
Actually, it was a lot worse.
The Buffalo Metalworks made fans of all sizes, including huge propellers for ships. Greg was fascinated by the mathematics of the curved blades. He was top of his class in math.
Were you an engineer? He asked.
Lev grinned. I tell people that if I need to impress them, he said. But the truth is, I looked after the horses. I was a stable boy. I was never good with machines. That was my brother Grigori's talent. You take after him. All the same, never buy a foundry.
I won't.
Greg was to spend the summer shadowing his father, learning the business. Lev had just got back from Los Angeles, and Greg's lessons had begun today. But he did not want to know about the foundry. He was good at math, but he was interested in power. He wished his father would take him on one of his frequent trips to Washington to lobby for the movie industry. That was where the real decisions were made. He was looking forward to lunch. He and his father were to meet Senator Gus Duer. Greg wanted to ask a favor of Senator Duer. However, he had not yet cleared this with his father. He was nervous about asking, and instead he said,
"Do you ever hear of your brother in Leningrad?"
Lev shook his head. "Not since the war. I wouldn't be surprised if he's dead. A lot of old Bolsheviks have disappeared."
"Speaking of family, I saw my half-sister on Saturday. She was at the beach picnic."
"Did you have a good time?"
"She's mad at you. Did you know that?"
"What have I done now?"
"You said you'd take her to the White House. Then you took Gladys Angeles."
"That's true. I forgot. But I wanted the publicity for Passion."
They were approached by a tall man whose striped suit was loud, even by current fashions. He touched the brim of his fedora and said,
"Morning, boss."
Lev said to Greg, "Joe Brakunov is in charge of security here, Joe. This is my son, Greg."
"Pleased to meet you," said Brakunov.
Greg shook his hand. Like most factories, the foundry had its own police force. But Brakunov looked more like a hoodlum than a cop.
"All quiet?" Lev asked.
"A little incident in the night," Brakunov said. "Two machinists tried to heist a length of 15-inch steel bar. Aircraft quality. We caught them trying to manhandle it over the fence."
Greg said, "Did you call the police?"
"It wasn't necessary." Brakunov grinned. "We gave them a little talk about the concept of private property and sent them to the hospital to think about it."
Greg was not surprised to learn that his father's security men beat thieves so badly that they had to go to hospital. Although Lev had never struck him or his mother, Greg felt that violence was never far below his father's charming surface. It was because of Lev's youth in the slums of Leningrad, he guessed. A portly man wearing a blue suit with a working man's cap appeared from behind a furnace.
"This is the union leader, Brian Hall," said Lev.
"Morning, Hall."
"Morning, Peshkov."
Greg raised his eyebrows. People usually called his father Mr. Peshkov. Lev stood with his feet apart and his hands on his hips.
"Well, have you got an answer for me?"
Hall's face took on a stubborn expression.
"The man won't come back to work with a pay cut, if that's what you mean."
"But I've improved my offer."
"It's still a pay cut."
Greg began to feel nervous. His father did not like opposition, and he might explode.
"The manager tells me we aren't getting any